Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message with me, Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And later on today, we are going to touch on a couple of important points that have come up in the more global tech scene, one of which is the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 launch, the launch of which Ian and I both attended. We'll come back to that towards the end of the show, but quite a few interesting news stories to get into before we get there. And the first is that the BBC iPlayer will require a TV license as of the 1st of September. For those of you who have been keeping tabs on the iPlayer license fee shenanigans since the charter review period, you all know that the main complaint has been that you don't need one to use iPlayer for on demand. So if you miss something on the telly and you go and watch it on the iPlayer the next day or an hour later or what have you, you don't actually need a license fee for that and never have, because the license fee was drawn up long before anything like on-demand existed. And that's always been a bit of a bone of contention for both license fee advocates and the BBC itself, because strictly speaking, you're kind of not paying anything to watch BBC content, so maybe you should be paying something. That's changing, Ian, isn't it?
It is, yes.
A matter of weeks from this. And this is, according to the BBC at least, not going to affect a huge number of people. They say that over 95% of households in the UK have a license fee already. And so anyone that already has that fee is unaffected by this. You're already covered. And fewer than 2% of households only watch catch up. And catch up was the thing that previously you didn't need the license fee for. So only 2% were saying, we never watch anything live, therefore we don't need a license fee. Only 2%. That, again, those figures according to the BBC. So this change is primarily going to affect that 2%. But in this tight margin world of BBC management, that's probably quite significant, don't you think, Ian?
I do, yes. And I mean, really, I just sort of wish this wasn't the problem and that people didn't require being told and that they saw enough value in the license fee to think that it was worth paying for. I mean, I certainly do, and I barely watch any live TV, really. The value in the BBC for me is those occasional programmes I do like and Radio 4, largely, if I'm completely honest. And of course, I have kids, so the children's services are second to none, and it's actually, when you have kids, I mean, all parents will probably say the same thing. You know, the programmes on CBeebies and stuff like that, not only are they not interrupted by adverts, they also tend to be subtly educational in a way that's quite cool. You know, it works really well. So this was inevitable. But I noticed they've rolled out the old license fee the license detection van nonsense all over again. The Telegraph picked up on a report, and as a result, has suggested that the BBC will be allowed to spy on users' internet connections to, if you will, sniff out iPlayer packets. Now, I don't know. I want to look into it and have a good sniff around. but they say that they can do that. Now, I don't believe it's possible to tell what an iPlayer packet is or any other packet unless you really, you know, get in there and do deep packet inspection and stuff like that, especially if people are using Wi-Fi with good encryption. But as I say, I haven't looked into it enough. I don't know the details. I'm not, you know, a high-level encryption expert or anything like that. But it sounds to me like one of those things, like the vans, which they told people existed, but most people don't really believe they do. What the BBC has is a database, and on that database is a list of every home with a licence and every home without a licence. And from that, they send inspectors around to knock on doors and say, do you have a TV? No, I don't. I don't have a licence, obviously, blah, blah, blah. And then the inspector goes away or tries to get it. I mean, the whole thing is actually fairly distasteful. It doesn't become the BBC at all.
This is probably quite interesting to our non-UK listeners who are not used to the idea of having effectively a state broadcasting service like this, but these are all things that do happen.
Well, license fees are very common all over the world. You will find them across Europe, New Zealand, I believe, South Africa.
Japan, NHK is license fee paid as well.
And in most of those countries, those channels also carry advertising. It's not uncommon to have a license fee, but of course the Americans don't. So you tend to get a lot of Americans saying, well, why are they charging me to receive something that I get for free over the air?
Well, let's talk a little bit about how this gets spotted then, because the first thing that struck me when I saw that this change was being implemented on September and was, well, good luck with that. You know, good luck enforcing this. And I wrote to the BBC and I asked their licensing body, their press office, for some details about how this is actually going to be done. Because in discussions we've had before, we've suggested that one very easy way of safeguarding people from accessing the iPlayer without a license is you create a login system and you say to people, well, you put in your, you know, your postcode and your license fee account number or something, that's your login, and yep. You apply that, and that's your, you know, that's your access code, if you like.
That doesn't work when you've got people who've got parents who have a license and they don't. But then I suppose that's a very small problem.
It is. And one of the things that from the response that I got is that, and this is a quote, in limited circumstances, students can be covered by the license at their parents' address. But here's the really interesting thing when it comes to these students. It has to be on a device that is powered by its own internal battery. So it must not be plugged into the mains when you're getting that live transmission. So if you plug it in and watch telly, you're not covered by your parents' license fee. If you watch it on your iPad without a plug, just on battery, then being covered by your parents may be enough.
Oh, it's just so stupid.
It is a little bit strange.
Who comes up with a rule like that? I mean, well, actually, I think that part of that would be because back in the day, but you know, back when this was actually sort of being written into the license, I suspect it was in the day of those little analog portable TVs, and which were powered by 6 AA batteries, which lasted 20 minutes, and you know, that was fine. You weren't going to have a license specifically for that, were you? But where you're talking about distinct students or people who live away from their parents who have phones with batteries which last 10 hours or whatever, it doesn't really feel like a very, like a modern way of approaching it.
Well, let me go into a few answers that the team that I spoke to did have. So firstly, this change applies to everything that is not broadcast TV. And so they say smart TV, desktop computer, laptop, mobile phone, tablet, digital box, which is a bit ambiguous, or a games console. And they also say if you access BBC iPlayer through another provider like Sky, Virgin Media, Freeview, BT, you would need a license for that. So they're basically saying this applies to everything, like absolutely everything that can receive the iPlayer. If you use it, you need a license fee. That to me is fairly obvious. But I asked specifically about enforcement and how they're going to enforce this. And they say, and these are quotes, I can confirm we have caught people watching on those devices using our normal enforcement methods, and this will not change following the closure of the iPlayer loophole. They also say that there are no changes planned at present which would require users to supply a TV license number, as in that login example we mentioned. So I went back to them and I said, you know, can you clarify what you mean by catching people watching on other devices? Because, you know, is this to say essentially that they could track someone down who are watching live on a mobile? So they replied again and said that they have caught people watching on those devices, and that the usual enforcement methods they use, which are like letters and visits, which is like what you have mentioned before, is one of the ways that they do that. They're also going to be having a new advisory notice on the iPlayer website, and they're sending letters to unlicensed addresses advising them about this change. And I had a look that they sent me the letter that they're going to be sending out to households as well. And it's very clearly written. It basically says, as of the 1st of September, a change in the law means you need to be covered by a TV license to download or watch BBC programmes on demand. It does, incidentally, exclude live radio. So if that's the only thing you use the iPlayer for, if you're just tuning in to listen to Radio 4 on a Sunday morning or something, technically speaking, you still don't need a license fee to do that via the iPlayer specifically. It's a two-page two-page letter that's going to go out, and it explains a lot of things like what on-demand is and whether this means you need to use it to use Sky Go or ITV. So, you know, it's a fairly nicely written, if extremely broad letter. Essentially, they're going to have to use the existing methods they've got, which is you know, if there is a house that doesn't have a license, they're going to send someone round and say, instead, do you have a telly? They'll say, do you have an iPad? Are you using a phone? And if you'd say, well, yes, I'm a student, but my phone isn't plugged in, you'll be okay. But let us know what you think, everybody. podcast@natelangson.com. Very keen to hear people's views on this one. And particularly interested if you've ever had a visit from any of these enforcement officers, or have you seen one of these much touted vans driving around at some point in your past. podcast@natelangson.com. In one other BBC nugget, Ian, we wanted to get to, and I know you wanted to mention this, BBC is doing 360-degree Olympic Games broadcasts. Fill us in, my friend.
Well, I got an announcement a while ago that NBC and Samsung had done a deal where they would exclusively on Samsung devices using Gear VR would be streaming from the Olympics. And I thought, well, that's not very good. I mean, I've kept that Samsung is the leader in sort of mobile VR. So it makes sense for it to be them. I don't think anyone else has really got quite the sort of infrastructure in place. But that doesn't really work for the BBC. The BBC won't do deals like that. It's absolutely impossible. So I asked and they said, well, we haven't got anything to announce now, but if there is in the future, we'll be sure to let you know. And sure enough, good to their word, they did. We've been obviously really bothering the BBC PR department this week, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
So BBC Sport 360 started last Friday. They're covering around 100 hours, I think, of total stuff at a choice of four camera angles and a 360 highlights package each day. It's a little bit maybe unclear about quite exactly what, but things like the opening ceremony were broadcast in 360. Beach volleyball, of course, because... people, boxing, gymnastics, stuff like that. So that's pretty good. It's good that they're getting involved. I mean, there will be a very small number of people that take advantage of that service, I suspect. But it's good that they're having a crack. And I like that. That's one of the things I love about the BBC. You know, they really try hard to get in on new things where possible, even if it's a minority uptake.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one because I think that quite a few people probably technically do have the ability to watch something like this. I mean, if you've got a modern Android phone and access to a Google Cardboard, you can use this. If you've got a Samsung Gear VR, let's say, and a new Samsung phone or a recent Samsung phone or a Note, you can do it on that as well. And similarly, they're doing this live. I mean, obviously the Olympics, huge amounts of it's live, but with this sort of thing, you often tend to encounter it, you know, after the fact, you know, in a sort of, here's a thing you can download and experience in a new way. But these 360 broadcasts are going to go out live. So it's not just that it's being done in 360 video. It's the fact that you'll be able to watch it in 360 at the same time that everyone else might be watching on TV, which I think, as you say, is really neat, very innovative. And I mean, it's kind of irrelevant to us in the context of being a UK-focused show. But over in Japan, NHK... actually is broadcasting some of the Olympics in 8K. And you need a kind of a prototype, I think it might be Pioneer or Panasonic box, and they're setting up TVs in certain places, I think, around the city or in offices where people can go and watch this happening in 8K. Let us know if you've got to try any of this 360 stuff out. I personally have not, but I did enjoy the BBC's what's it called when when it was the Queen's Jubilee, her birthday a few weeks ago, they did a 360 video of something to do with the colours. Remind me of it. What's it
Trooping
called?
Trooping of Them.
Thank you. Yes, Trooping of the Colours. They broadcast that in 360, and I watched that in 360, and I thought that was a neat little experiment. But
like being there.
Almost like being there.
I mean, you could have gone because it happens sort of pretty much every week or something. You like me. I don't have any real problem with the monarchy, but I don't seek out to see them in any manner.
Well, this is going wildly down a royal rabbit hole that we did not come to dig today. Okay, Ian, let's talk about the effects of Brexit. We've touched on this subject before now when we told everybody about Dell and I think HP raising the prices of their products for IT products in the UK by about 10%. I think we talked about that a month or so ago. It's actually one of our most popular episodes ever. Mm. So a lot of people listen to that show. But it's happening again, and this time perhaps a little more closer to the consumer heart of Britain, which is that the HTC Vive, the 360 degree VR headset Vive, is going to be £70 more, 70, in the UK, and HTC has essentially blamed Brexit. They put a message on their website in a blog post, and they say, a message to all our UK customers. HTC continuously monitors and adjusts pricing to ensure we are providing our customers with the best value possible. Due to recent currency valuation changes and the current value of the pound, we are adjusting the price of the HTC Vive in the UK to £759 plus postage and packaging. The adjustment will come into effect Monday, August 1st. And then they go on to thank people for their support.
So, on the plus side, though, Nate, just get a loan, because the interest rate is now 0.25%. So just get a loan and pay for it that way.
As somebody who very recently bought a house, I'm fairly sensitive about the Bank of England's interest cut.
Well, it's good. Are you on a variable rate by any chance?
No, I'm not. You're on a fixed. I'm on fixed for 5 years.
That's a smart move.
Well, it was at the time.
Well, it still is, because you were probably fixed at a pretty low rate, right?
Without going into great details, it was certainly a very competitive rate, and I'm certainly not unhappy. Let's just put it that way. But this is a shame, right, Ian, though? I mean, £70 more for
it's
what is already an
amount.
Extremely expensive product.
Look, I'll be completely honest. I am on the verge of considering a Vive. Like, I don't think there's enough material for it, but I believe that HTC has really nailed this piece of hardware. It's the thing that Oculus has some issues, and not least their attitude. And also, I was speaking to a mutual friend of ours the other night, after the Samsung event, actually, Rick Henderson, and he tells me that if you get sunlight in the lenses of the Oculus, it can severely damage the OLED screen in absolutely no time at all. And it's happened to him, and he says he reckons they've told him it less than a minute can be enough to damage the screen. So for me, Vive is a really appealing proposition. I think it's the smartest system. I think it comes as a good package. It's a bit more expensive, except now it's a bit more expensive than Oculus. I'm probably going to wait this out. I think maybe I'll get a Vive in the second generation, but it's disappointing.
I think we have to expect that the Vive in at least one generation, maybe a second, is going to go wireless, as will all of these things.
It's hard, though. It's really hard. It's not so much about the amount of data you need to send. It's about keeping that all-important latency down to absolutely nothing at all.
It's true, but there are wireless standards that are out now where the latency is extremely low on very high-frequency radio technology, and I don't think it's going to be too long before this goes wireless, and that is inevitable. Like, it is inevitable this will go wireless, and I agree with you. The Vive is the most impressive of these. I used it. I went round to CNET's offices a couple of months ago, and they had a kit set up in a room that was dedicated to it, and got to have a play, and it was amazing. But I couldn't get away from the fact that, as amazing as it was, as immersive as it felt, as impressive as it was, and I did walk out of there wanting to buy one, was that I've got a big ass cable hanging down my back, and at some point I'm going to trip up and tangle myself. And I thought, you know what, for this amount of money, this early on, with so little content, I've been burned by buying a 4K TV too early. I'm going to wait another year, and I'm going to get the nice sexy wireless one that'll cost less.
Fair enough.
Well, let's pull back our eyelids, peer far over the curvature of the Earth, past the Atlantic, and check in with Tom Merritt at Daily Tech News Show. Tom, what's been going on this week?
Thank you, Nate. This past week on Daily Tech News Show, we dived into why Uber wants to become a mapping company, got a first-hand review of the Xbox One S from Lamar Wilson. Probably don't need one. Discuss when it's okay to let kids use tablets. Short answer is anytime you use it with them. We discussed the US ISP's plans to charge you to protect your privacy. And we wondered if we ever again will be able to own our software instead of have to subscribe to it? Turns out the answer is a qualified yes. All that and more on DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom. Right, Ian, let's talk about Ofcom. Ofcom.
Oh, yes.
The Ofcom section.
the Ofcom section of the show.
Absolutely, yeah. Ofcom, very interesting to talk about. Now, there was a report on the Register I read about Ofcom releasing some research that suggested the UK's telco market, you know, mobile and fixed line and what have you, was worth almost £40 billion, £37.5, £38 billion. That was the headline. I'm not interested in that. What was really interesting to me inside this was some of the figures that came out of this report. And the one I'm going to pick out first, Ian, is that according to Ofcom, which for anyone outside the UK, that's the body, the regulator that oversees all of Britain's telecom services and TV and everything, almost half of all mobile subscriptions, mobile phone subscriptions in the UK are now 4G. 40 million. And bearing in mind, we have a population of about just under 60 million. That's pretty impressive.
I was yawning, and not because of a reaction, anything about this story, just it's been a long day. Yes, it is incredible, isn't it? I mean, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and mobile subscriptions have increased 1.8% to 91.5 million, and this is all during 2015. So these are figures that are a few months old, but it's to encompass a full year, I believe. But yeah, almost half of connections in 2015 are 4G. 4G.
So, I mean, people have got multiple connections, presumably. This is why that number is so high.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, the other side of this, of course, is that a lot of providers are switching on 4G without any extra charge. So
yeah,
people have got access to 4G without having to have a special contract or anything. But still, having more than or almost half of all people using 4G in the UK, I still think is pretty impressive. We also have now 9.2 million homes in Britain have speeds up to 30 megabits per second. That was 7.1 million in 2014. So a good general speed bump over the UK. And the other thing that I found interesting in this report was to do with text messaging and multimedia messaging. Now, I'm pretty sure if you go out anywhere, look at any smartphone, people are using WhatsApp, they're using iMessage, they're using WeChat, they're using all these different chatting services, Facebook Messenger, obviously, as well, I should have included. It's all data, none of its texts, none of its multimedia messages. Ian, without looking ahead in the script here,
yeah,
guess how many text messages were sent? In fact, guess how many were sent in 2014?
Text messages in total.
In total, text and multimedia messages sent yearly in the UK or from UK devices in 2014. I'll give you a clue.
Yeah.
It's measured in many billions.
Oh, really? I was going to say a billion. Let's go for 10 billion.
101 billion.
Wow. That's staggering, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, I've done it the wrong way around. That was the number sent in 2015.
Right.
So that was last year, 101 billion text messages, multimedia messages,
okay,
were sent. In 2014, it was 110 billion. So only
right,
9 billion fewer between 2014 and 2015.
Only 9 billion. I mean, that's...
But out of 110 billion, and the reason why I say only is because in 2014, 2015, the number of people signing up for and using services like WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger. I mean, Facebook bought WhatsApp for billions in 2014 because of the number of people using these. And yet, only 9 billion fewer text messages were sent in Britain between 2014 and 2015. That just seems tiny given the rise of these platforms.
I mean, yeah, there are certain people who you just don't. And there are certain things where WhatsApp just isn't a thing. Like, for example, my haircut, my, you know, certain things like parcels being delivered. Those are all services which are not available on WhatsApp, are they? And this is partially WhatsApp's fault, isn't it? It's not as easy for someone to text you on a WhatsApp number, although theoretically it is, because they don't give you an external, like, username or something like that. Theoretically, WhatsApp WhatsApp could be a hub for all manner of things if it was properly used. But text messages remain something that's baked into a lot of systems. Like that, you know, there are obviously pre-built hairdressing solutions where they have a schedule and a back end that does text messaging. So that, I think it's not going anywhere. Plus, everyone, you know, lots of people have got mums and dads, and mums and dads are notoriously bad at moving with the times.
True. Although I have to say, my mum uses WhatsApp.
Yeah, mine doesn't.
Right.
I get text messages, and that's fine because text messages are essentially free, and they, you know, you can communicate the basics, can't you?
Yeah, you certainly can. But you lack emojis, and
I mean, that really isn't a problem.
I don't know. I'll tell you something. My mum has sent an increasing number of inline emojis. Sometimes reading texts from her now is like reading chicken licking. In a good way, I have to say.
I can't do it, mate. I can't read emoji text where the, you know, the, there is a series of images. I don't know what half of them are. I'm really bad at it. I was a text, you know, an emoticon man.
Yes.
If you will.
Yeah. When did that change? When did the emoticon become the emoji? I remember putting on Twitter a question about what the difference is, and someone said, well, an emoticon is when it's done using ASCII characters. Yeah. So, you know, colon, hyphen, close bracket for smiley face.
You're only allowed to use
emoji
the standard.
Is a actual picture face.
Yeah. It's like a proper image, isn't it? It's not, it's generated by the handset, isn't it? I assume it's represented in another way. But the whole thing's exhausting. I mean, I like emoji. It's fun. But at the same time, I was, you know, we used to do amazing things with ASCII. Like, there are some good examples online, if you care to look, of things that are actually quite remarkable.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a few favourites, most of them vulgar and obscene. Does your mother send you obscenities via emoji? podcast@natelangson.com. Send us a screenshot. Well, before we end the show and come to an email, we wanted to touch on the Samsung Galaxy Note 7. Now, we don't often talk about actual gadgets on the show, largely because you've heard them everywhere else on all the other tech shows. But I did want to mention this one just because, just because Ian and I both were at the launch and I was sitting behind Ian, who was playing Pokemon Go during...
Don't tell them that. I was listening intently and playing Pokemon Go.
But we did want to talk about the fact that we both like it. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this, Ian. And just before we do, quick recap. 5.7-inch screen. It's very, very interesting. It's a black oblong. It's quite expensive, it works underwater, and it scans your eyeballs for security. I think that's about a fair summary of the new oblong.
What did you think about when you picked it up? Did you feel like it felt like it feels like a much smaller phone than you would expect for a 5.7-inch screen, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And I think part of the reason for that is that it is smaller than most other 5.7-inch phones would be, because the bezel around the edge doesn't really exist on the left and right, because like the edge, the Galaxy Edge, the screen does curve down the side. And so you get that extra screen size without that extra few mil of bulk around the edge. So it feels more like a 5.5-inch phone, even though it's 5.7.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the real skill of it. And also, I think that now they've made it symmetrical. That makes me very happy, because I'm a man of symmetry, so I don't like unsymmetrical things. So now that where the front curves to the side, the back also does the same, and I think that really helps with the feel.
It definitely does. And the iris scanning tech was an interesting one. I had a pre-briefing before the announcement and got to try this iris scanning system, which is basically, it's got an infrared camera on the front of the phone, in addition to the regular visible light camera for taking self-portraits and stuff. And it has got a system that lets you scan your iris, not your retina. It's keen to point out this is iris scanning, not retina scanning. It's very, very different for security reasons, but still, nonetheless, good enough to be used for, you know, people to put their passwords behind and even do banking deals. Apparently they've got a partnership with some banks for using this. But basically you hold the phone in front of you, and in my test, less than a second, it recognized my eyes and unlocked the phone. It was no faster than using a fingerprint, but it did technically involve less, you know, input from me. I didn't have to swipe my thumb down or hold my thumb over the sensor. You just look at the phone as you would anyway, and it unlocks.
Also, I was told in an interview in that pre-briefing that it's 100 times more secure than a fingerprint.
I can believe that, but both can be cloned technically. Fingerprints using 3D,
iris is much harder though, isn't it? I would think.
Almost certainly, because it's very difficult to do a 3D plastic mould of your eyeball.
I don't think you would do that. I think the trick would be to get a very, very high resolution image of someone's eye and then use that to log in. Now, I'm sure that the very, very clever people in the world will try this as soon as the phone comes out. And we'll either see a story about it being hacked in about a week or about it being not hacked. Either way, it doesn't really matter because it's not about that, is it? It's the security that it gives you is one of convenience, and it's secure enough for most people. If you're running a country, then perhaps investigate a longer passcode instead. But if you're
just do both fingerprints and iris.
Well, I wondered about that, but I don't. The Samsung doesn't support it, does it? But I thought that would be a rather good idea if you could do both.
Yeah, so you have to hold your finger down and look at it at the same time.
I mean, it would work, wouldn't it? Or just one after the other, if necessary.
I think that would work.
I think that would work. Well, perhaps we should make that happen.
Well, it's a really nice device, and I have to say I was very, very impressed. And we're a couple of weeks away, we expect, from the announcement of Apple's new phone. And although we are suspecting that Apple's going to include a lot of interesting new features, it does seem that Samsung is ahead of some of the rumoured features that we don't yet know about.
It's really very, very impressive. And yeah, it's been a really good year for Samsung. They've made more money. The S7 is a really good phone. They've managed to get to the point where they can turn a profit on the edge screens now, which was a problem for them last year. I get quite angry. Obviously, a big part of what we do for a living is talking about how companies are struggling to innovate, this, that, and the other. But we've got these phones that do absolutely everything. I struggle to think of something that my phone can't do that I want it to do. I mean, things were never going to carry on as they were forever, were they? It's impossible.
Well, just rummaging through my feedback sack here, we did. Last week, ask you with a greater degree of urgency to send us some emails because we know a lot of you listen, as you tell as you do, and the numbers are pretty obvious when I look at our dashboards. But you write in less than you used to. Don't you love us anymore? Seriously, we were number 9 in the iTunes tech charts yesterday, so someone loves us. Why not you, eh? Well, Stephen does, because he wrote in to say, in response to our talk last week about Robot Wars, nostalgia isn't what it used to be, but watching bigger, badder, remote-controlled contraptions hurling themselves into orgies of destruction certainly brings a tear to my eye. But here's the rub. While DARPA had the great challenge for robots, we get a barely progressed Robot Wars, where we should be seeing something like the Great Egg Race crossed with the Krypton Factor for autonomous robots. Love the show, Stephen. Well, Stephen, we'd love your comment.
Quite, and I did say, didn't I, it's not Robot Wars, it's Remote Control Car Wars, really, because that's what they are. They're just remote control cars which are heavily armoured.
There was a bloody great one on last week's show, actually. They had this big spinning love disc orbiting it. It looked like someone had shrunk Saturn down to the size of a robot and turned the rings of Saturn into a big serrated edge blade. It was a lot of fun. Really liked it. But thanks for your comment, Stephen. You and Ian definitely in agreement there, I think. We also had another interesting note from... we had a few here. I'm just trying to pick out who we're going to get some messages from. Kimberly wrote in from the US with a very long but interesting email about Amazon Fresh. We talked about Amazon getting into the fresh grocery delivery business here in the UK and the Amazon Dash. And one of the things that she mentioned that was a bit of an issue is things have melted for her in transit between being dispatched from Amazon and arriving at her house. And I thought this was really interesting because that to me feels like a very US-centric problem in that a lot of stuff has to go via road, but for quite long distances, whereas in the UK, even if it's delivered by road, it's generally not as hot and also generally not as far.
Yeah, but I mean, they do have refrigerated vans in America. It's not an unusual thing to have as part of your delivery system. I mean, I think that food delivery in the UK is very advanced, actually. We're quite lucky our supermarkets jumped on it quite quickly. I don't think it's like that in the States. And I would welcome anyone else to write in and, you know, tell us about what is and isn't available. And the context of that is, if you are an American, in the UK, every supermarket delivers to pretty much every home. So you can have everything sent to you in a van if you want. But I mean, yeah, it's funny how they don't seem to have thought of that sort of basic stuff. But who knows?
Yet. I mean, Kimberly mentioned, this is an interesting line, that she loves the service for dog food, sodas, I think that's what they call fizzy drinks, paper goods and staples, which is an interesting combination if all used for the same thing.
Presumably she doesn't mean staples as in the thing that staple paper together. I assume she means the basics of cooking. But is that...
Well, I don't know, because the previous one was paper goods.
Well, that is true. I mean, I don't want to besmirch Kimberly's good name, but I'm now having a sort of a vision of a hot American, I mean, hot in the climate sense, stapling paper endlessly. She might be hot physically as well. Just
this is a terrible hole to be down.
It really is. Please send help.
Stuart wrote in to mention that he enjoyed the high quality of the show. Thank you, Ian. We enjoyed the high quality punctuation and grammar of your message. It was perfect. And he said that he just wanted to mention on our discussion of the Amazon Dash and how much easier it can make shopping. He just wondered why people would pay for them, if he will. But when a lot of the existing supermarkets have this barcode scanning tech, that's, you know, it's free of charge. So why would you use a Dash? And Ian, I think you had a point about this when I forwarded you this email.
When I was looking into Dash, it implies that when you do your second online order, they'll send you one for free. So while I agree with him, in theory, I think they're all sort of onto that. But also, there is an advantage to having a specific device to do a job like that, where it's just in the kitchen, and when you run out of something, you just scan it. You know, phones are very convenient and work perfectly, but there's nothing quite like picking something up and just using it, you know.
Plus, I suppose the physical presence of it standing there is a reminder to use it and to think of Amazon.
That's yes, spending more money. Absolutely, yes. Mm.
Yeah, good point, Stuart. And finally, just a quick note to thank everyone who wrote in and politely commented that there may have been an audio encoding issue at the end of last week's show. There was an error on the export for some reason, and a lot of people got a very robotic sound during the Robot Wars section if you downloaded the show quickly enough. So apologies for that, and thanks to everyone who flagged it, and I hope you all got the fixed version. In fact, I know you did, because I looked at the numbers, and you did. So I suppose you're welcome. But also thanks. Okay, well, we're going to leave it there before I sink myself deeper into this pit from which there is very little chance of any humane escape. But you are welcome to send further emails to podcast@natelangson.com. Keep leaving reviews on the iTunes store for us. It got us to number 9 in the charts last week. So 140 of you giving 5-star reviews in the UK alone. Had a look at the other stores around the world, and there's loads there too. So thank you so much. That's the difference you make, and that's why we don't ask for any money or sponsorship or anything like that. So thank you. Keep the emails coming in, and we'll see you, assuming I get out of this hole, in a week.
It's nice that you joined me in that hole, you know. After I dug myself a nice little pit, you then followed suit and dug yourself a little hole.
What do you call a hole that's built within a hole?
There's no answer to that.
No, there isn't. podcast@natelangson.com if you have one.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.